Welcome to the Morning Philip series, co-sponsored with the Bush Foundation and the NUMAG Group, hosted here at the Garage. The purpose of the Morning Philip series is to discuss philanthropy, civil society, and community. It is an opportunity to have conversation with good people doing good things creatively and collaboratively. The format is a conversation, not a presentation, a dialogue, not a pitch, two chairs, a table, and a community of interested people. Today we are pleased to have with us an international recognized engineer, author, and leader, recognized for his innovative mind for the STEM fields, as well as an understanding of human relationship. The NUMAG Group would like to extend a special thanks to the Cheeseman Center for Sound, Barefoot Dance Studio for the chairs you're sitting in, Scott Sumner for brewing coffee, Dalton for helping set up yesterday. We want to thank the members of the Garage co-working space for letting us use your office, the Bush Foundation, and for everyone here for joining us at 7 a.m. Please join us on Facebook, engage in the conversation, hashtag MorningPhilip. Now, with all of that, please join me in welcoming the chief engineer for the Mars 2020 project, Dr. Adam Stelzner. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me, Matt. Very much.
So this is your first time in South Dakota.
It is.
You've actually visited every surrounding state.
Embarrassingly so, but not.
And you've been here for about 24 hours,
yeah.
or will have been here for about 24 hours. And yesterday, you spent time at School of Mines with students at lunch, and then as well you lectured and took questions in the afternoon.
Yes.
And then we
had dinner last night.
I know, it was a
very
packed agenda. So this morning, if we start off with this question. When you look in the sky, what do you actually see?
That feels like a trick question. When I look in the sky, I see the stars, if it's a clear night. Actually, so I think maybe I'll try and make some hay with that question. When I look at the sky, fundamentally and most importantly, I think I see the same thing that all of us see. If I were to try and take that question and make it as philosophical as possible, I very much operate under the assumption, and it really only can be an assumption, but the assumption that we live in a singular deterministic universe that actually is, and that we can figure out, maybe, eventually, through looking at it, thinking about it, what it really is. But that if you want, or I want it to be different than it is, I cannot, that want means nothing to the universe. So that when I look at the sky, I think I see the same thing that you do, or we are converging through time, through the imperfection of our perception, to eventually see that which really is. And for me, it's a beautiful, massive, scary, vast, mostly lonely space, filled with wondrous things, and I'm pretty sure other creatures, but at least, you know, it's very unfriendly. I'm familiar with the sky, the stuff that's outside the atmosphere, and it's not warm and cuddly.
So there's a lot there, and we unpack some of that over the next hour. You're familiar with the sky. You led the team and the design to land Mars Curiosity. Can you talk about the role of creativity, of the creative mind, and what seems like it must have been very technical, it's a very technical and scientific field. What's the role of the left and right brain to accomplish the things like landing Curiosity on Mars?
Great, good question. So I'm going to go to this quote of my own, self-indulgent. Let me allow myself to quote myself. Scientists prove and engineers guess. And why I say that is because engineers are in the process of building things that have not been before. And scientists are mostly in the process of defining that universe that we are living in now. And so it existed prior to the scientist, and they are looking to understand it. Why do I mention that? Because the act of creating something new is, as the words that describe it suggest, a creative act. Right? You're inventing something. You're solving a problem in a way that has not happened before. And that is fundamentally creative. And so the creative elements of one's brain and psyche must be brought to bear. So it's really a fun process for me, and I think it can be for anybody, because there's this great interplay. You create an idea, you have an idea, you investigate an idea, and then, in sort of a ebb and flow, you bring an analytical mind, and I always get which side of my brain is which, confused. But anyway, with one side, you generate, and then with the other side, you interrogate. And you go back and forth between that, sort of searching for the true value in the new idea. Right? And so you've got to use both sides of your brain.
You're a musician.
Yes.
Were you...
A very poor musician.
How has that been a part of what you just talked about?
So I started out as... I was a poor student in high school, and I started out as a just playing rock and roll.
Sorry to interrupt. You're a poor student. Is it true that you might have failed geometry?
Yes. it is true. In fact, I passed geometry the second time with, I kid you not, an F+. And it was really because, and I don't want to disparage her, but and she may likely not be alive anymore, but because Miss Hunter just didn't want to see me in the classroom anymore.
And geometry wasn't the only subject that you worked hard at, but physics in your selection process, it sounds like.
Right. I had done a really good job of convincing myself that I was not an academic. Really, in hindsight, our capacity for self-delusion is massive. Mine in particular. So I'd convince myself and by my parents and all the teachers I'd ever had that, oh, yeah, he's bright, probably, maybe, I don't know. But just not a very good student. And, and so I played rock and roll around the San Francisco Bay Area, and eventually I got bored. And one night I was noticing that the stars had moved. They had been Orion. We'd been in the east when I went to go play a show, and it was in the west when I came home. And somehow that sparked my curiosity. I had forgotten the whole Earth spinning on its axis thing, so I had this sense of vague motion of something with respect to something else. Were the stars moving? And I wanted to take... I went down to local community college to take an astronomy course. Because astronomy was about the stars, and the stars were moving, and so they would teach you about why the stars were moving. The stars aren't moving. The Earth is spinning on its axis. So, and it had a prerequisite, which almost cooked the whole deal. It was actually called a co-requisite. You were allowed to take it at the same time. Called physics. And I was like, I'm not sure, really. But it was called physics without math. And it was specifically the without math part. I'm like, all right, I'll give that a go. And kind of the joke was on me because there weren't enough people who signed up for the astronomy course. So there, the astronomy course was canceled, and there I am in the physics course. But it was awesome. It took that little spark of curiosity and lit a fire.
You were at JPL, and for about 9 years, the Mars Curiosity rover was being developed, tested, and launched. Mm-hmm. 9 months of travel, about 9 months of mm-hmm. travel to Mars, and a unique first ever landing design was implemented. Your design, you led the team. Can you run us through that process to get to that design, the alternatives of it, and bring us
cool, yeah.
update us or provide that information?
So we'd been to Mars a few times. We first landed on Mars in 76 with Viking. And those were legged landers. And then I was unsuccessful, scientifically disappointing, for a host of reasons, not the least of which being that we were trying to look for life on Mars with 1960s technology in biology, which literally meant taking dirt, rubbing it into a Petri dish, and waiting to see if something grew, which if you do that with dirt on Earth, it's not a even though dirt on Earth, if you look and you really interrogate it, it's just teeming with life. But that subset of life, which is called cultivatable, that I can actually get to grow in a Petri dish is a very small subset. So anyway, whatever. Disappointing. We'd go back to Mars in 97 with a little tiny rover, Sojourner, and we'd use a crazy landing system then that cushioned the final impact with airbags. And we'd go again with a pair of twin rovers with airbags again. So we were kind of in the mood to use that same system again, except this time we were taking a very, very large rover. And so we were forced out of that comfort zone. We couldn't make the bag system work. And so we tried to make a non-airbag system work. And we came together in September of 2003, which I can see some of you weren't born then. And we gathered together all the folks that had some experience with landing. And we brainstormed the last piece of the puzzle. We were going to use every single way, all the same stuff that we did before, but when it came down to that final touchdown system, the final impact, we were looking for a different way. And it was perhaps one of my awakening moments to lessons, sort of deep, hopefully transferable lessons that I learned from the laboratory that I can share with other human beings to use, whether you're making a car or analyzing a electrical power grid. I noticed in that room over those few days that we separated naturally the ideas from the people that held them, and we respected in a very fundamental level the people, regardless of how successful the idea that they were bringing into the discussion was, and we allowed the ideas to be put into competition with one another without being protected by the people who brought them in. You know, so frequently we attach ourselves to an idea. And I don't know about you guys, but when I have an idea, the moment I have an idea, the femtosecond that I have an idea, it is the most brilliant thing that anybody has ever thought of. I mean, I'm like, oh my God, I am a genius. That is fantastic. And then from that point on, the idea does only one thing. It slumps in my esteem as it meets the world and reality and slowly descends until such a point as either I disavow having ever had anything to do with it,
Who thought of that? That was whack. No.
Or it sort of levels off above some level of utility that makes it a useful and enduring idea and maybe gets used for something. So, but that all of us, I think, have this great ownership with our ideas the moment they come out. But what I noticed we did in that room when we invented the sky crane is we did a good job of letting go of that. Because, you know, as that idea is descending, I'm kind of always disappointed. And so if I intervene on behalf of my idea to try and protect it against the outside world, it doesn't descend as it really should to the real level of true utility, true value that I need to understand it to have. And so at any rate, we did that in that room organically because we'd been doing it at the laboratory for years and years and years because the laboratory started as the first place to put stuff in space for the U.S. And when we started, we didn't know how this was being done. This is the 50s. I wasn't alive yet. But they didn't know how it was done. And because nobody knew how to do it, it encouraged a very flat organizational structure because a good idea could come from anybody. And you don't want to have like, well, I'm the king of ideas and I only listen to the dukes of ideas and the dukes of ideas only listen to the barons of ideas. And so somewhere down in the feudal serf can't get the idea up. So starting, you know, years before my parents met each other, the laboratory was had this appreciation for ideas regardless of where they came from. And I noticed that most and learned that and got that message during the brainstorming session that generated this weird thing where we lowered the rover and what we called the sky crane.
So that reminds me, what you just shared reminds me of what you wrote in your book. And I quote you here. I was driven simply by curiosity and the need to overcome my insecurities.
Well,
can you talk about that?
Yeah. For me, learning about the universe, the world we live in, how it works, is a calming experience. I can be very confused. And as a kid, I was very confused about, like, what's going on in this world? When I discovered that there are actually just like a handful of equations that govern the behavior of almost every physical thing, inanimate object we see, they probably govern our behavior, but there's so many states in our brain that it's very hard to notice how those equations are doing it. But this teacup, totally not nailed by a few different equations. And the idea that you could understand the world, that you could, through math, predict the future state of the world successfully, was like an incredible calming influence. It was a very exciting and emotionally calming because it sort of gave me a, whoa, I can figure this out. You know, it doesn't have to be so gray and confusing. You know, I found physics when I was a musician. And I can remember feeling confused as a musician because I love music. I play it poorly. But I was trying to be a rock star. So we were playing shows and the success of our following was just as much about the clothes we wore or the clubs we played on what days or who opened for who. There's so many pieces of the puzzle that didn't seem to be derived by the merit of the thing that we were actually doing, the music we were actually making. And that lack of a meritocracy, maybe, that grayness, that ephemeral, fashion-y, who, you know, was just bewildering to me. And the alternative, which is, well, there is actually a universe out there and you can figure it out, was awesome. And so that's why I think I took to it so much.
And you had to figure it out. to land Curiosity on Mars and to for these future projects. But that involved, if I understand correctly, there's a 14-minute time lapse.
Mm-hmm.
What you write about and you talk about is the 7 minutes of terror,
mm-hmm.
where Curiosity is moving from about 13,000 miles per mm-hmm. hour towards Mars and then stops mm-hmm. on Mars.
Hopefully very gracefully.
Right. And you talk about these 7 minutes
mm-hmm.
where thousand people have worked mm-hmm. towards this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And really you won't even know if it does it for 14 more minutes.
Yeah.
Can you take us through those 7 minutes?
Yeah.
And what happens to Curiosity? But what happens to you and your team?
Yeah. Yes. So I'll start with defining a bit the stakes, because everybody could think of the stakes differently. Like we'd spent $2.5 billion. Was that the stakes? Honestly, I don't care about our $2.5 billion. I vastly more was concerned about my 3,000 some odd colleagues' 10-year investment, right? Everybody that I knew in my community had put their shoulder to the wheel for a decade. And I was desperately concerned that some inadequacy on my part could jeopardize that investment of their lives. So we had a fantastic team, really incredible team of people. On the landing team itself, it's about 50. And we were all gathered in the control room to listen to the events. We didn't have any control of the events. There was this 14-minute light time. It takes 14 minutes from the signals to move from Mars to Earth. And it takes 7 minutes to get from the top of the atmosphere to the bottom. So by the time we get this first signal, the rover's been alive or dead on the surface for 7 minutes or so. So we're watching. We've done all the thinking that we can. We've built software. We've written computer code to put all the smarts about what the rover should do inside the bowels of the computer, and it's going to sense things, and it's going to do its thing and fly itself to the surface of Mars. And it hits the atmosphere going about 13,000 miles an hour. It's protected by a heat shield. It slams into the atmosphere, does about 12 Gs, 14 Gs, depending on the atmosphere on the moment when we show up to Mars, and burns a hole in the sky of Mars, and that slows it down to about 1,000 miles an hour at about 5 miles above the surface. We come out of the parachute, or we put a parachute on the, we open up a parachute at that point. That slows us down again. On landing night, that gave us 9 Gs of deceleration. That slows down to a couple hundred miles an hour. And so as these things are going on, we are watching the telemetry. We're watching the data come back. In my chief of staff, good friend and colleague, and now the leader for the landing system on 2020, Alan Chen is giving the play-by-play. He is watching the data come across his screen and announcing over the VOCA, the communication system that we're all talking to each other in the control room, which is also being broadcast over national and international television, and 57 million people are watching, is announcing the play-by-play. And actually, I'm going to back us up. EDL really starts 10 minutes before we touch the atmosphere. We have this big solar array and a propulsion system that took us to Mars. And we throw that away 10 minutes before we hit the atmosphere. And the vehicle itself takes control in a much more active sense. It stops spinning. It turns itself to an entry attitude. And then we wait for 10 minutes. And those 10 minutes were the most agonizing 10 minutes of my life, because it seemed like forever. We're waiting for the first signal, the first piece of data that tells us that we're touched the Mars atmosphere and we're starting to enter the Mars atmosphere successfully. And you can't write this stuff. The very first signal we get from that comes across the screen, I'm standing behind Al and I'm looking, says, and I'll explain what this means, beta off nominal catastrophic. So we are coming in with this heat shield that's sort of shaped like this. The spacecraft is also protected by behind it. And as it as we come in like this, this angle here, which would be like pitch in an aircraft, you know, pull the stick back, is called alpha. And the yaw side slip is called beta. And if we've got a couple of pressure ports on the heat shield to give us information, just telemetry. We're not closing the loop. We're not doing any active control on those pressure ports. And they were the first time we'd ever put them on a vehicle going into Mars. So they were an interesting sort of experiment in collecting data. But the beta measurement, this will yaw, if it was over 10 degrees off of zero, because we're supposed to come in straight, that got us a catastrophic. That was considered catastrophic. Because, for instance, we could have the vehicle coming in like this. Because once it's in the atmosphere, it will be stable and it will trim to a particular position. But we separated 5,000 miles from where we were, no, 15,000 miles from where we touched the atmosphere, and we turned the vehicle how we thought it should be so that when it got to the atmosphere, it was pointed in the right direction and it was engaged with the atmosphere in the right way. And so when that first thing comes back, the very first thing, it says, oh, you screwed that up, and it's over. And so, you know, I was very much unlike an athlete. An athlete might, or they coach athletes in the audience, they tell athletes to visualize the successful thing that you're going to go do. Right? I'm a tennis player, I'm going to visualize slamming the ball. And that works because when you visualize it, you're actually in control of your body, and maybe that makes it better for you. But I'm not actually in control of the robot. The robot's in control of itself, and we put software in to do that. And so visualizing success, to me, felt like a dereliction in duty. What I should be doing is visualizing failure, discovering new ways that it might fail, and then figuring out if I can make code to help it behave in a way that wouldn't fail that way. The whole team was job after we built the thing, after we created it, was to try and figure out ways to destroy it. And once we figured out ways to destroy it, change it so that it could not be destroyed that way. So I had not thought about success. I'd only thought about failure. And so I kind of was just waiting for the failure. So when that first beta catastrophic comes, I'm like, pardon my French, holy shit. Already? Like, that's it? We didn't even get a play? It's just like, boom, done, off. And they forfeit. And then a second later, it came back nominal. And it's because the early measurements were ill-conditioned and it was a spurious measurement. But that, you know, that started the party, you know. Whoosh! Secrete all the adrenaline you have into your bloodstream. Zing! Electrified arms. And so then we go down this sequence of events. And Al is there reporting on them. And all of us are reading various pieces of data as they come across the screen. And everything seems to be going right. Which seems weird to me. Because I haven't pictured it that way. Right? I'm waiting for the anomaly. Anomaly is what we call a screw-up. That's our word. I'm waiting for the anomaly. Parachute deploy. Okay. I mean, the parachute is our most risky thing. You know, we give it like a 1 in 50 probability of failing. So parachute deploy. And we slow down. It means it works. Okay. Great. Heat shield separation. We're in this capsule. We've pull the parachute the slowest down. We let go of the heat shield. We've got a radar system that looks down, starting to look down at the surface. We developed that radar system ourselves from scratch. Super bad idea. Seriously. Anyway, but it worked. And we did a good job, but it was a battle the entire way. So the radar works. In fact, the radar converges. The radar gets a solution. When we start at the top of the atmosphere, we tell the spacecraft, we think you are here with respect to Mars. From Earth, we're looking. We think you're here with respect to Mars, and we think you're going this fast in this direction. And then the spacecraft has a sensor called an IMU, an inertial measurement unit, which also doesn't have a lot of information in it. It's gyroscopes and accelerometer blocks, and they can, just if you close your eyes and you walk, you're doing inertial measurement. You're feeling gravity, you're feeling acceleration, you're trying to decide where you're going and how far you've been by integrating that in your noggin. That's what we were doing from the top of the atmosphere until we opened up the heat shield and looked down with the radar. And we anticipated that when we looked with the radar, because the radar was going to measure our speed with respect to the ground very accurately, that there might be a large difference, as much as 60 meters a second, 120 miles an hour speed error between what the guy with its eyes closed had been doing at the end of a few minutes and what the guy who opened the eyes and, whoa, I'm going at a different speed than I thought I was. But we get the results back. I mean, instantly it comes back and it's got a 7 meter a second error, which is super tight. And we're like, so we're going down these things and it's all working. And I'm like, I'm becoming more and more incredulous. I'm like, this can't be. It can't just happen like this. So Al had been given license. We had all decided together that Al could have license to say the data as it came up without confirmation or filtering all the way down to the bottom. The reason was this, is I didn't want to ever have to walk us back from saying, yes, we did it. Ooh, no. So, never mind. No, we didn't do it. As you're going down the atmosphere, going through EDL, there's so much death awaits you that saying I've been successful this far or successful this far is kind of harmless because there's still a lot of death that remains. But that final touchdown, that's where you're done. So we had three signals we wanted to look at for that. We wanted to look at that the rover said it had touched down, that the rover's IMU said it wasn't moving, so it's not being dragged around by our sky crane thing, and then that the antennas that are talking to us on top, fragile antennas, do a good job of talking to us for at least 10 seconds. That means that the descent stage, the jet backpack, hasn't fallen on top of the antenna and crushed it. If those three things happen, it's very, very likely that we have a certified success. It was my job to give the okay, to watch that happen and tap Al and say, okay, you can now, you know, we're ready to go. So we're going down, we're going further, we start the sky crane. And so I know what those three things are. There's one, the first message from the rover was an EVR, an engineering record that came out that said touchdown nominal. Now, since we were going to be announcing this over the VOCA and to 56 million people, we didn't want to use those words, because people might say, oh, yay, we landed. And then the other things would come back and we'd say, oh, no, not really. So Joni Davis had this from Langley Research Center, was in charge of looking for that signal, and she was in charge of, and she announced it as Tango Delta nominal. So I hear Tango Delta nominal. I hear RIMU, rover, IMU, nominal. And then I'm waiting for this kid Brian Schratz, who's watching the telecommunication signal, to give me 10 seconds UHF. Of course, he's so a Twitter. I'm counting. I'm looking across the control room at him. And he's just like, UHF good, which is not really what he was supposed to say. But 10 seconds has gone by, and he says that, so then I tap Al. Anyway, so I tap Al. Al says, touchdown confirmed, we're safe on Mars. And the room explodes, and I'm still there waiting for the failure. I'm like, that's it? That just happened? I mean, that's it. It just happened. I mean, it's a very strange thing. It's like, you know, running for 10 years of your life. Run, 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 run. And then you cross the finish line and you stop running. And your body's like, what is this? I don't even understand this. And literally, I mean, we're hugging each other, but it's surreal. It's like I'm, you know, people say, walking on a cloud. It really felt like I'm not touching the ground. I'm in a bubble. I don't even know what's going on because I can't believe that it all actually went that way and it worked. So that was my experience of those 7 minutes.
Thanks, Adam. What do you suppose the landing means to the 57 million people? What do you suppose that means to people that weren't
there?
Right.
Well, I have thought about that a bit, and mostly only since landing, because people kind of freaked out. I had people on the street tell me, which for me it's not the same, but they're like, that was like Apollo moon landing. And I was actually alive for the Apollo moon landings. You know, watched my dad freak out about the Apollo moon landings. I was 6, so it was like a little abstract for me. I mean, I got it. It was cool. But the incredible profundity was a little bit over my head. But I watched people be moved by it. And I have come to believe that that it's an... When we're doing this, we're kind of doing... This is... Some people find this to be... I know lots of my colleagues hate when I say this, but they can't stop me. It's kind of like performance art. We are sort of asking the question of what is possible for us human beings to do. And so it's the art of the possible. And I think the thing that is so powerful for people is wondering that about us, right? Who are we? What can we do? What are we capable of? What is the edge of what we are? And when I think we landed, I think why people watch it, why 57 million people watched, is because they're wondering that. You know, who are we? We're real weird creatures. We beat on each other. We love each other. We're, you know, do all sorts of things. But sometimes we come together for a common purpose, and we can do some pretty crazy cool stuff. And so I think there's that meaning. You know, we're very curious creatures. We have always, us Americans in particular, we sort of were filtered out from the rest of people who are willing to put a lot at risk to cross oceans, what's over the next ridge, what is out there? Let me keep going, that exploring urge, which is just following our curiosity. It's a drive. And when we're doing it in space, we're sort of doing it together and we're asking questions about how much exploring, how hard of a job can we do? So I think that's why it connected with people.
And that reminds me of, and I really appreciated your words about the practical application of space exploration and how you spoke about that yesterday a little bit. Would you share a bit more about that?
So for When I was growing up, space exploration was rationalized. The shuttle, for instance, was rationalized by spin-off technologies. Teflon, for instance, which makes many of our pans slippery and makes a really good seal. I mean, this is a very, very useful substance. Was discovered during the Apollo engineering effort to put humans on Earth and bring them on the moon and bring them back safely. And Tang came out of that. So mean. Tang! But eventually I've come to feel that that is the most cowardly rationale for us exploring. Because I'm kind of drawn to being slightly provocative and a bit iconoclastic. So I vastly prefer to say that we do it for no good reason. It's not, it won't make the price of gasoline cheaper. But I observe that all of the greatest things that make us who we are done for no good reason. Music, art, sport, literature, dance, architecture. I mean, you keep going, right? All the things that define us as a species are things that don't make the price of gasoline cheaper. Now, you can make money in all those things. You can sell T-shirts at a sporting event. You can maybe be a successful, if you're David Koons, you can get paid millions of dollars for your sculptures, right? But that's not why athletes are running around. If they were not paid at all, there's a lot of amateur athletes. We still do it because we're still wondering, what can I do? How fast can I run that 100 meters, right? And so when those are things that we do that are not particularly reasonable and don't have a great impact on heating our homes next winter, and yet they define us as a species, who we are and what we're capable of. And I like to think of exploration as another one of those gestures of our humanity.
What's the best piece of advice you received?
The best piece of advice I've received probably has been from my friend, colleague, Richard Cook, who was the project manager for Curiosity, who married me, who admonished me to always remember to give it away. I am comfortable in the limelight. I am instinctually drawn to attract it. And yet, everything, the universe is a better place when I constantly work to give it away, to my colleagues, to step out of it as best I can.
What's the best piece of advice you've given to somebody?
Well, okay, I'm going to answer it in two ways. There's advice that I give. There's kinds of advice that I can give that people are like, okay, cool, great, thank you. That's successful and it is absorbable. And then there's the most profound advice that I can give, which seems to always bounce off everybody. And I don't think it has had any effect on the universe. I'll tell you both. The former, the stuff that actually works, is I advise students to take time being a student. Because I've never met anybody who's graduated college, who wishes they graduated college a semester or a quarter or even a year earlier than they did. Give them a couple years working and they're like, I kind of wish I'd taken that other course. Right. And they don't have to be courses that, again, just like that which makes us great as a species, that which makes us full as an individual does not always contribute to the bottom line of our paycheck. You know, of that history course, I'm an engineer. That means I should take only engineering courses. But then I don't really know the world I live in, right? I don't appreciate, I happen to take a Lakota history course in university. Actually, interesting little tidbit. So I did very well in school, in college. Eventually, I figured it out, and I did very well. And I was the valedictorian for the College of Engineering at UC Davis. And I had the speech all set up, and the dean was very happy. And I was also very in competition to get the university medal, which is for the top student in the university. And I was the runner-up to the university medal. But I was the valedictorian for the college, and I we're getting ready, getting close to the graduation time. We're like a few weeks out, and the dean comes to my, brings me to his office, sort of sheepishly. He's like, we're not going to be able to actually give you your diploma at the ceremony, because in the state of California, you cannot receive a bachelor's degree from the state of California university system if you have not successfully completed high school American history. I spent a lot of my high school not in high school, and so my sophomore and junior years were 1A and 5Fs. Actually, the sophomore year was 1A and 5Fs. The A was in theater, the Fs were in everything else. Then they decided that maybe I was bored, so they put me in a special program so I could take more classes. And then I got 1A and 6Fs. So I had to take a course, and I took this Lakota Sioux history course over the summer. Anyway, but the point is, I'm here, and that course is working its magic on my neural pathways, right? And so the best advice I give, I think, is to students to not rush it and not do only the things that you think you're going to do in your job, because, boy, life gets pretty damn boring if that's all you do. And then you step into 30, 50 years of career doing the same thing. Wow, it's going to grind you into bone meal. The advice that I give that no one chooses to take me up on is that, and I believe in this very heartily, very fully, that happiness, that effectiveness as a professional, that effectiveness as a citizen comes most profoundly if you are very self-aware. That self-awareness is the start of our balanced relationship with the world. So if I've got an agenda inside, or some loop inside, or some battle with my younger brother, or my mom, or the fact my dad didn't do something, or did something else, or whatever the heck, that's rolling around in my noggin that I don't appreciate, it will voice itself in my behaviors with the outside world in a way that's not balanced with the information that comes from the outside world. And I can watch that happen with colleagues, family members. When I get a response that's like, whoa, where did that come from? I check in with myself. Did I give more than I thought in that? Or was there something going on inside that person that is just not... And if I look at my work, or even... In my friends, at those people who are the least happy, they are most unhappy because of this dichotomy between what they think they want and what they actually want. And so they think they, for instance, a great thing that you find in engineering school is people who are going to engineering school because a counselor told them they were good at math, or their dad was an engineer, or their mom was an engineer, or something like that. And they're like, and they're like, eh. In reality, they don't really like it. But they're doing it, and they haven't even connected with the fact that they don't like it, and they're going to go do a thing, and eventually it'll be a lackluster thing, because if you're not in it, boy, if you're not really in it, this is life. Every moment that happens is the life you have. And the more you're in it, the more life you have. So at any rate, that's the advice I give, that all happiness starts with self-awareness. And people are like, cool. Check, please.
You talk about the dark room. Mm.
I do.
What do you mean? Please.
Yeah. So in our work at the lab, but this is true in life in general, we will find ourselves with a predicament, with a problem, with a roadblock in front of us that we don't have a solution for. In a team engineering position, you come against a failure of a thing. Our terminal descent sensor, our fancy radar that we decided to build from scratch, had a near-field antenna interference, and we had to totally reconstruct the antennas, and we couldn't figure out a way of doing it with the number of antennas that we needed to do. And we're like, and there's this sense, an easy instinct to sort of panic. You're in like a dark room. You don't know the way out. You feel trapped. You're in the darkness. And so what I try to do is remember a couple pieces of advice. To be comfortable in the dark room, I try and encourage the team members to be comfortable. Like, relax, it's going to be okay. Everybody's always worried that it's not going to be okay. There's this great saying, a coward dies 1,000 deaths. And I can tell you, as a coward, how many thousands of deaths I've died. You know, oh my God, this is it, this is it. Oh, isn't it? Okay. And the thing is that I think it's vastly better to be surprised by death, both as a human and real death, and even the analog in a team where you really, if you really get to a place where you can't find a solution. I've actually never found that place. I've always felt that place. Oh my God, we're in the dark room. We don't know what we're going to do. But relaxing, sitting with the open question, considering it, to date, there has always been a solution. And there will always be a solution until you die. And so allow yourself to be, both at work and in life, surprised by death. Don't anticipate it all the time. Be here, do your thing, try and make the thing happen, and the day you can't is the day that it's over. So the dark room is that experience that the team has when we are stuck and we don't know the way out. And it's especially important in a team setting that you give the team solace at that point, because it can be very anxiety-provoking and people can just, morale can start to come apart.
So we're coming, we only have about 5 minutes left. Okay. But I've got a lot more questions.
Okay.
Most important characteristic of leadership. In your mind.
I do wish I'd taken you up on that offer of looking at the questions ahead of time. I think the most important characteristic of leadership is an open-mindedness. I think in every pursuit that humans engage in, be it engineering, be it developing ringtones, governing a city or a state or a nation or a whatever, that the ideas, the successful ideas for this thing that we're doing together. If you're leading a group of people and you're doing a thing, that the ideas, the most successful solutions to that thing that you're doing can come from anywhere. And as a leader, you must be open so that they may not come from you. And you must somehow be comfortable with owning that reality. Because if you do, then you've got the power of all of the members of the team. And there will be times, you know, you might be the leader because you're pretty good at ideas or pretty good at synthesizing ideas. But that really does not guarantee, or it should never even be perceived that it has anything to do with that you've got all the ideas. And so it's being open-minded. Open-minded and vulnerable to the possibility that you're wrong, that your team is wrong, that you've went down a wrong path, that there's a better idea out there, and able to synthesize that, absorb it, and bring the team into it.
You write, power, thermal, and communication stability are the golden rules for space flight.
Mm. Yes.
What are the three words that you explain the golden rule of life?
Again, God, if I'd only looked at those. The three golden rules. Self-awareness. Compassion. Ambition.
Thanks. Paula Kerger with PBS was our last month's guest. Mm-hmm. She wondered how you deal with using current technology on a project that will be years in the making, knowing that technology will be dated and obsolete by the time the project comes to fruition. Could you share a couple words about that?
Yes.
Please.
I got my PhD in 1999 from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And when I was working on my thesis, I worked on an early pre-Steve Jobs return to Apple, but very fancy at the time, G4 Macintosh, sort of beige boxy thing. The G4 Macintosh was powered by a PowerPC 750 chip. In the year 2020, we will launch the world's biggest rover, because it'll be a little bigger than the last time, to go to the surface of Mars and collect samples for eventual return to Earth. That rover will be powered by a PowerPC 750 chip. By the time it makes it to Mars, that computer chip will be well over 20 years old. It will be 25, 26 years old technology. I actually think that using old technology it's like collage. You're using old technology, but you're arranging it in a fashion that does something truly novel and different. I don't need fancy piece part technologies to create an emerging technology or emerging function that itself is unique and has never existed. So that's what I do with old technology.
Our next guest is Dr. Jason Purnell. He leads the project For the Sake of All at Washington University in St. Louis. The project focuses on improving the health of all people by eliminating racial inequalities in the St. Louis region. What would you ask him?
Well, I do think that there is, so what would I ask him? God, I would ask him to teach me through the data that must be out there how those opportunities for health cut across socioeconomic and racial lines. Because I know that that's true. I think we can most powerfully solve it with data to help us understand really what's going on.
Adam, thank you for taking time. Coming to Rapid City, Adam was up at 1 a.m. our time yesterday to make the trip here from Boston, mm-hmm. after being in Boston for about 24 hours.
Yeah.
And we have more conversations today, mm-hmm. and then you head back to California. Really, thank you for your willingness to be here, to join in this conversation and the ones yesterday. We have a gift from the Black Hills Works, oh. Susie Kappa Center. It's a piece of artwork.
Wow.
Made by an artist here in town at Susie Kappa Art Center, a place where all people, anyone can work in the studio there. But hope that finds a place in your
That's
office.
Beautiful. Yeah.
And you remember your first trip to South Dakota. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.